Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the redactions underway on the 400-plus page Mueller report in the hands of William Barr, who has wide discretion over what is revealed and what is blacked out. With Barr scheduled to appear before the House and Senate Appropriations Committees on Tuesday and Wednesday, no doubt Democrats will press for an immediate public release, while Barr intends to release his edited version of the report in mid-April or sooner. Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Attorney General in the Justice Department, joins us to discuss his article at the Washington Post, "Release the Mueller Team Summaries Now," and how competing camps inside the DOJ of unnamed Mueller and Barr loyalists are airing their positions to the media as Barr, Mueller, and Rosenstein work on redacting the report. After 22 months of disciplined silence from Mueller, now amid leaks and counter-leaks, we will try to determine whether or not Barr was chagrined that Mueller did not reach a conclusion on Trump's guilt or innocence on obstruction of justice, and if so, why then did Barr not instruct Mueller to follow DOJ regulations and return a judgment? With one of the most consequential investigations in American political history now in the hands of someone who many see as having already put his spin on the report's main finding to exonerate Trump, we will assess this muddled moment when much of the public is demanding clarity. Then, with the president's chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, saying Democrats will never see Donald Trump's tax returns, we will speak with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who co-founded DCReport.org and is the author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. He joins us to discuss the escalating battle between the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, who has asked the IRS for Trump's tax returns under an existing law that grants him that authority, and a defiant and determined Trump administration. Then finally, we'll look into how Joe Biden is stumbling before he's even out of the gate entering the presidential race due to charges by a Nevada state lawmaker Biden was campaigning for, who claims he kissed the top of her head inappropriately, but she added it was not sexual. We will assess the apparent double standard in which Democrats are quick to jettison Biden and Franken for minor transgressions compared to the head of the Grab Our Pussy Party, Donald Trump, who has paid off porn stars and playmates and has 16 women accusing him of sexual harassment and sexual assault. An expert on feminist ethics, Frances Kissling, joins us to discuss Obama's warning that the Democrats are forming a circular firing squad as progressive purity endangers their electoral chances in 2020. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney General and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who is currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he has an op-ed at the Washington Post, "Release the Mueller Team Summaries Now." Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Oh, thank you, Ian. What a big load of news you have.
Well, welcome to the...
trying to hold my breath.
Welcome to the Trump era, Harry. So, you know Barr, right? And you've spoken fairly positively about him. So give us your take on who you think this man is.
I have. So, as I've said before, I don't feel differently about who he is. I feel he's an institutionalist, a person of integrity, someone, a grown-up, strong enough to stand up to the president. I've always had one misgiving or concern, and that has to do with his views on executive power. And I am, in fact, concerned that those views may have come home to roost in the letter and in his judgment. In other words, we don't know. But if it turns out that his and Rod Rosenstein's reasons for basically countermanding Mueller and imposing their own judgment was their own calculation of the limitations and demands of executive power, and in a word, that a president exercising his or her enumerated powers can't really obstruct, that would be grievous and worrisome. And I have said that from the start. but the more sort of dark ideas about him as a political toady, I think, are not well taken. And I do think he knows and favors the Department of Justice, and that will inform him. Of course, doesn't mean he'll wind up in the same place as Bob Mueller, who certainly is every bit the institutionalist that Barr is.
But that's where people are speculating, right? What is the distance between them? And the fact that they're working together now would indicate maybe the distance is being exaggerated. I've heard that that Barr kind of wore him down and sort of talked him out of obstruction of justice. But then the Washington Post has said that Barr was chagrined that Mueller did not reach a conclusion. And as you pointed out, if so, then why didn't Barr instruct Mueller to follow DOJ regulations and return a judgment? So deal with that, if you will, Harry.
Yeah, I mean, that's just it. Look, they are working together. Mueller is a very respectful of chain of command kind of person, and Barr is the top of that command. Still, the big mystery is, as you say, why did Barr, forget about Mueller, for the moment, although it's very important to know why he said, I'm not going to do a judgment. But why in those circumstances did Bill Barr say, I have to step in and reach this judgment, and I'm doing it abetted by the longtime deputy and fairly respected deputy Rod Rosenstein? There are more or less sinister accounts for why that happened. I'm sure he's going to be pilloried with questions about it Tuesday, even though the hearing is styled as an appropriations hearing. The real testimony on the report is until early May. But we just got to know that. We've just got to know that. Is it based on some fairly marginal or at least extreme view of, presidential executive power? Is it based on something to do with the evidence, even though Mueller spent 22 months Barr, I don't think he only spent a weekend, but he spent, maybe closer to 22 days, let's say. And the reasons are absolutely pivotal. That's why I said in the op-ed, there are summaries that Mueller's prepared, and this team, in this very unusual, after 22 months of great discipline, that there's now the sort of more normal leaking and war of words within factions in the department. And there is the suggestion from the Mueller team, look, we've got these summaries. We created them for this purpose. They give our thinking, if not the evidentiary support. And I have said in this op-ed, let's hear the thinking. I mean, we want the analysis. We'll get to the evidence, yes. But I mean, that will answer the question, what was Barr doing and what was Mueller doing in not reaching the bottom line decision? And just one final point, which is I have read these reports that the from the Post and otherwise, that somehow the regs required the attorney general to step in and make that judgment. I don't see it. I don't understand what about the regs place that as a requirement. And so that's part and parcel of what the attorney general has to answer. What would have been so contrary to law or otherwise?
So, Harry Lipman, are you still with me? You dropped out. Quick, you better call him back again. I'm speaking with Harry Lipman, who's a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he has an op-ed at the Washington Post, release the Mueller team's summaries now. And we're waiting to get Harry back on the line. Are you there, Harry? Not yet. So again, we'll continue our conversation as soon as possible. And we are calling him back. So again, I'm speaking with Harry Lipman, a former United States attorney appointed by Bill Clinton. He's also a deputy assistant attorney general in the DOJ, and he's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he has an article at the Washington Post. Are you there, Harry? He has an article at the Washington Post, release the Mueller team's summaries now. And I'm waiting for Harry. Are you back?
I am. I'm not sure where you lost me. I spend a lot of time talking to myself.
It's okay. I introduced you a number of times, so that much we've achieved. But let me ask you, though, about the thing that really is bothering about this, and I mentioned in the opening, that is, you know, we're at this muddled moment when much of the public is demanding clarity. And this Mueller report has probably been one of the most consequential investigations in American political history. So do you think Barr understands that, that this is just not how a democracy should work? If you're going to spend 22 months on an important report that has the public waiting for bated breath, and now we don't know what we're going to see, when we're going to see it, and whether what we see is going to be the real deal.
Boy, I do. How can it be otherwise? A person with any sophistication and public background, his parents are professors at Columbia, that's where he grew up. He has to understand the public imperative of seeing this. Maybe he's thinking about short-term versus long-term, but I don't see how he can miss that. It's one of the reasons my op-ed says, well, we've got these summaries now. Maybe they don't have all the evidence, all the grand jury material, but release those at least so we understand where Mueller was coming from. I personally, you know, this is a legal view, but really a realpolitik view too. I cannot see this stuff not coming out. But there's, a timeline issue that dovetails with the 2020 election, and perhaps that's in people's minds uppermost. But I'm sure he understands that. On the other hand, he's the chief federal law enforcement officer in the country. Let's say that, you know, his read is that the rules on grand jury information doesn't permit it. That's a bit of a fix. So I think there's always a way around it. There has been in the past. If he's really earnest about getting it out, there will be a way to get out almost everything with just a couple exceptions in the short run.
But the op-ed that you wrote at the Washington Post, Harry Lipman, released the Mueller team summaries now, asks the relevant question, which is, if these summaries, which were done by the people who did the Mueller report, and they deliberately scrubbed them so there'd be no redactable material, what is the reasoning why they weren't released? Because the thing that makes people suspicious about Barr is that his four-page summary that did not even have a complete sentence from Mueller's 400-page-plus report, and whether or not he intended it, there's no question that Trump seized on it. And as you and Bill Yeomans have written in your blog, right?
And Barr must have known that would happen. I've got this new podcast, TalkingFeds.com, where just now we finished taping, and Joyce Vance, Paul Fishman, Matt Miller, and I discussed this at greater length. But it does seem to me, here's the ostensible justification, Ian. They say, well, the pages are marked grand jury material. But that's really pretty weak tea, because you always mark pages like that. If Mueller's team designed them to be able to go out quickly, then they could. And look, they've had them now for weeks. Why isn't that the first thing they've been scrubbing? So you're right. There are suspicions that the letter fails to accurately capture the Mueller report. Those suspicions are now being driven in part by people in Mueller's team who are finally now leaking. And the best way to dispel them is to provide it. And if there turns out to be, a really inaccurate summary there in that original Barr letter, you know, woe unto him. I would be, you know, it would be a really tarnishing event for someone who's had a sterling professional reputation.
So if the worst is true, based upon suspicions that have been aroused by the impact of that four-page summary that's got, Bill Yeoman said the other day on this program, Barr intercepted the football and scored a touchdown, and the Republicans are all dancing in the end zone, most of all, of course, President Trump. He also mentioned, by the way, that he thinks that the whole thing could turn and there could be, you know, an enormous backlash. But if just assuming for a moment the worst, what would Barr's motives be for doing what many are accusing him of doing. Would it be to save the Republican brand ahead of 2020? I can't imagine, even though he's appointed by Trump and auditioned for the job, he seems to have come from that school, and so does Mueller, and so does Rosenstein of conservative Republicans. They come from the school of, you know, more like the Jeb Bush school than the Donald Trump, you know nothing kind of version of the Republican Party.
Right. So I'll just have to say prefatorily, it pains me to assume the worst of Bill Barr, but let me answer your question on its merits. Yeah, the thing that people are most troubled by, but I think is not too likely, is some kind of personal service to salvage Trump himself. I see that as Barr as being, you know, it's one of the reasons I thought he would be a good pick. He would not toady in that way. There could be some kind of, you know, salvation of party idea behind. He is a strong Republican. That would be also improper and would pain me. There could be some kind of, you know, Gerald Ford moment of we have to, you know, end this national nightmare and save the Republic. If that's his view, it sounds enlightened, but I don't think it would be. It's real. At this point, the Watergate analogy, Watergate had played out then, and we knew the story, and that he was closing a chapter that had already been read. Here we don't know the story. We have to know the story. If that's what's in Bill Barr's mind, then there's, you know, it's at best a wrong-headed. Those are the things I can think of. And then there's some, you know, possibility that this is just his reading of the law, that he really did have to make a judgment. He really thought Mueller should have. But that seems tenuous to me. So, I know people like on talkingfeds.com, we offer opinions, but this really is an abiding mystery. And sometimes you have to say it. And we need to see those damn summary, not to mention the rest of the report, in order to judge just this question and know what kind of problem we have on our hands.
But just in closing, Gerald Nadler, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, he's not wrong, is he, in saying that that these reports would normally go to the House, because the House, under the Constitution, has the responsibility for impeachment, if indeed it's warranted. One of the ironies that I find about this is that the DOJ regs that people are complaining about were set up because of the abuse of Ken Starr, who just went up, just dumped everything and on the open with all the salacious and tangential material about Bill Clinton's private sex life. And they decided they didn't want that to happen again. And of course, it's an irony that a former prosecutor dumped damaging material to destroy the presidency of a Democrat who was impeached. And now you've got material being held up by a special prosecutor. And many people think it's to protect a Republican president who might well be guilty of crimes that could impeach him. So I see that as an irony.
Yeah. Well, look, putting on my hat as a Democrat, and I am a Democrat, it does seem like the party has gotten the, you know, crap kicked out of it for 20 years, but by losing these extremely narrow, a whole series of, you know, games in overtime. The short answer to your question on Nadler, though, I'm sorry to say, Ian, is it's not so simple. The Starr report, as you say, was under a different regime. And Watergate, there's a fight about that. What was the basis for its release? The court that will probably decide this ultimately, the D.C. Circuit, just ruled 2 days ago that you can't go outside the four corners of the law that gives specific exceptions. You can't just do a loosey-goosey judicial discretion. The good news, though, is they read one of the exceptions to say you probably can turn it over to Congress. And I do think that will happen. There are the national intelligence, okay, but you can turn it over to the heads. The ongoing investigation, okay, but that'll be small. And then this fourth category seems to have been made up, unduly prejudicial to uncharged parties. The real big ticket item here is the grand jury info. And I you know, it will be a battle. It'll take time, and time is on the Dem, is not on the Dem side. But I think they should ultimately win.
Well, Harry Litman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you, Harry. And again, I've been speaking with Harry Litman, who's a former United States attorney appointed by Bill Clinton. He's a was also a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department. He's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and he has an op-ed at the Washington Post, "Release the Mueller Team Summaries Now." We're going to take a brief station break and assess Trump's vow that Democrats will never see his tax returns. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump, a 13-year veteran of The New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, and he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. And he recently co-founded DCReport.org. And his latest book is "It's Even Worse Than You Think: What the Trump Administration Is Doing to America." Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston. David, are you there? David, are
Hello,
you?
Ian. Hello, you? Ian. Glad to be with you again.
Oh, thanks, David. Now, the threat or the vow by Mick Mulvaney, the acting White House Chief of Staff, that the Democrats will never see Donald Trump's tax returns. How does that gel with what I understand is that the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee actually has asked the IRS for Trump's tax returns under an existing law that grants him that authority? So is this bluster on the part of the White House, or do they have a case?
This is an effort to create a dictatorship in the United States and to replace our Constitution with something that will be horrible for everyone who isn't taking allegiance to Donald Trump. In 1924, we adopted through our Congress an anti-corruption measure that says that when the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, that's the tax writing committee whereby the Constitution requires all tax laws begin, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, or the chief of staff of the Joint Committee on Taxation. So that's a person who's not even an elected official. It's a staff person, an eminent tax lawyer. If they request tax returns and related tax information on any person or corporation or other entity from the IRS, it shall be provided. Ian, shall is a mandatory word. There is no wiggle room here. What Mick Mulvaney is saying is that Donald Trump is above the law, and we should – I don't understand why people are not in the streets over this protesting. We seem to – oh, well, you know, that's Donald. We've normalized this behavior by Donald Trump, and it's astonishing to me that there isn't public support for this. Whether – even if you support Donald Trump, he's not above the law if you want to continue to live in a country that has the liberties we enjoy.
Well, but Trump has a loyal toady as his Secretary of the Treasury, and he's in charge of the IRS, is he not? So does Trump have any authority there, since this is a matter that involves the IRS clearly?
Well, first of all, yes, the IRS is under the Treasury Department. It has always operated independently. One of the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon was his attempt, and I emphasize the word attempt, to use the IRS to go after his enemies. But this has nothing to do with politics. Either we are a nation of laws, or in we are just another dictatorship in the making. This is crystal clear. The tax returns have to be provided. And the mere assertion that they don't have to comply with the law speaks volumes. And I think the reason people aren't upset about this to the degree they should be is, you know, we've largely stopped teaching civics in America. My students, who are pre-law students, and when I was teaching third-year law students, those and my graduate business students, most of them had no idea what is in our Constitution. They had no context about the historical reasons that we have the protections of our civil liberties that are in the Constitution. There is an active movement in this country to repeal the 14th Amendment, to which some members of Congress subscribe. That is the amendment passed after the Civil War that makes sure that we all have equal protection of under the law. There's an effort to undo this, and we are heading into a very dangerous era, and if people don't wake up, the United States of America, as we know it, may not endure.
Well, we have a team of grifters and a serial criminal who might well be a traitor in the executive branch, and they are rapidly turning this country into a banana republic. And I share your alarm, David, and I'm also even more alarmed at the apathy or the extent to which we're normalizing criminal behavior. But is there any silver lining here? Is the chair of the – I mean, I know that Trump has apparently appointed his tax lawyer to be the new commissioner of the IRS, but the current commissioner, is he going to do what the law requires and honor the request by the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee?
Yeah, that's not quite right. The current IRS commissioner is a California tax lawyer who specialized in helping billionaires get away without paying the taxes that they owed. This was his specialty. And in fact, one of the richest, biggest tax cheats in America was one of his clients. So Donald Trump picked someone, Charles Rettig, to be IRS commissioner whose history was not one of enforcing tax law or having a reputation as someone who defended the concepts of tax law, but someone who grew very rich representing people who could have gone to prison except for his legal skill at getting these turned into civil matters and through threats of litigation allowing them to pay pennies on the dollar of what they owed. The new appointee he's made is a former is a tax lawyer who worked closely with Sherry Dillon, who's Donald Trump's principal lawyer on tax and business matters. And that person will be chief counsel at the IRS. There are only two political appointees at the IRS, the commissioner and the chief counsel. And they report separately and independently to the Treasury Secretary. They do not report the chief counsel does not report to the head of the agency, the commissioner. And Trump asked Mitch McConnell to prioritize the confirmation of his proposed chief counsel ahead of everything else, which tells you that Trump is trying to evade the law. But, you know, we have a lot of principled people in politics in this country. There are lots of Republicans who have been saying privately all the way along they know that Donald Trump is incompetent, he's mentally ill, he has no business being president, but they won't stand up to him because every single poll shows that if they are challenged in a primary, they will lose. There's a word to describe these politicians. They are cowards. More than 1 million people died so that we could be free. My father was a 100% disabled veteran of World War II who died prematurely because he served his country. And that you are unwilling to risk being voted out of office because Donald Trump has this hold on a lot of voters, you're a coward. You have no business serving in office. You should resign, and we should shame you for the rest of your existence. People take an oath of office to our Constitution, and they are violating that oath when they know who Donald Trump is, but they won't act on it.
Well, but the fact that Trump has that ability to make those threats, in other words, the threats can be carried out because the constituency exists. It's as though...
Absolutely, they can be carried out. And better to be voted out of office and have your integrity than to serve as someone who's a spineless, servile violator of your constitutional oath. You know, the whole principle of democracy, of what was a radical idea in the late 18th century, that we would rule ourselves rather than King George or any other individual, depends on courage and integrity and on rational debate and civic reasoning. And we're ignoring that, and we are doing so at the peril of all of our freedoms, regardless of what your political or religious or other interests are. We all either we all have our liberty or we allow it to be taken away by people who have no regard for our Constitution. It's at the end of the day, our Constitution is a piece of paper. It depends on people with integrity and courage making it work.
Well, the good news is that the majority and a considerable majority of Americans do not belong to this new iteration of the Know-Nothing Party, the so-called Trump base that's captured the Republican Party and got these Republicans, you know, quivering, in quaking in fear of being primaried. So I don't know. I think the invocation should be, you know, not much you can do about the people inside the Fox bubble except accuse Murdoch of being more dangerous than Trump. But you can do something about the majority of people who are the majority, and they've got to assert themselves because the country is literally being turned into a banana republic, and we can't survive four more years of this guy, and nor can the planet survive four more years without addressing global warming.
So, and here's the real problem. Even though there are polls showing that somewhere around 57, 56, 58% of Americans say they will never vote for Donald Trump in the 2020 election, he could lose by millions of votes, by many more millions than he lost the popular vote in 2016, and still get a second term because of the Electoral College. All he has to do is win the states in the South and the key states that he won the last time around. In fact, he doesn't even have to win all of them in order to get in. And so he could be a minority president by a large number, and you give Donald Trump a whole 8 years, at the end of that period, he will be followed by a jerry-rigged, not gerrymandered, a jury-rigged voting system where we've denied the franchise to millions and millions of people, as Republicans have been doing for years now in a number of the states, and we will lose our liberties. So the fact that the popular vote will go against Trump has nothing to do with whether he gets a second term.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, at the risk of depressing our audience further, and I think that
I hope activating and
well,
and
exactly
encouraging them.
Exactly, that is the answer. But I'm just curious to know, what is Trump afraid of with his tax returns? Is he afraid that the public will learn that he's not a billionaire? Is he afraid that it will reveal how much he's been financed by the Russians? Or is it a combination of both?
Well, first of all, we don't necessarily get to see the returns. The law involved says they're provided to the chairman of the committee to use in closed session. Now, we may get to see them, but we may not. But what the tax returns will undoubtedly show is Trump is not a billionaire. There's never been any evidence that he is, just his claims, that he has cheated on his taxes. And let's remember, it's in my biography of Trump, The Making of Donald Trump, with links to the court decisions. Donald Trump was tried twice for civil tax fraud. He lost both cases. The judges excoriated him for fraud. And hardly anybody knows this because no one in the mainstream media has reported this for reasons I find absolutely mystifying. The other thing Trump has to worry about isn't just money from the Saudis, the Emirates, Russian gangsters. What he has to worry about is the books and records of his company, if they haven't been destroyed, probably do not line up with what's on his tax return. If you do that once, it's a civil matter. If you do it repeatedly, it's a criminal matter for which we properly prosecute people and upon conviction, put them in prison.
Well, didn't Michael Cohen in his public testimony more or less raise a red flag and point in that direction?
Absolutely. Michael Cohen, although he's not seen Trump's tax returns, has made it very clear. But let me tell you why I'm so confident about the tax issue. During one of Donald Trump's two tax fraud trials, his longtime lawyer and tax accountant, who also represented his father, Fred Trump, was shown the tax return in dispute, where Trump claimed over $600,000 of losses against a business with no income, and he had no receipts, no documents, no nothing. And the lawyer was shown the tax return, and he said under oath, "That's my signature, but neither I nor my firm prepared that tax return," which is as strong a badge of fraud as you can imagine. Donald Trump took the properly prepared tax return and changed it after the lawyers and accountants had signed off on it. So I'm sure that a proper audit of Donald Trump will show tax fraud.
And what was your mailbox, in your mailbox, right, appeared the 2005, what was it, the short form?
No. What I got in 2005 in my mailbox was the first two pages, the Form 1040. Your tax return is everything you file with the government.
Right.
But the summary pages are the Form 1040, and they showed that Donald had an income of $148 million, and he paid income tax of less than 3.5%. He paid additional tax called the AMT of $31 million, but that's a temporary tax. He got that money back in future years. Basically, he had to loan the government the $31 million at zero interest until he took it back the next year or 2 years. So his real tax rate of less than 3.5%, why is that significant? Because in 2005, the poorest half of American taxpayers, whose average income was $16,000, that's $300 a week, they paid more than 3.5% in income taxes. So here's Donald Trump with almost $3 million a week of income, and his tax burden was lower than that of the poorest 50% of American taxpayers. And that's the system he wants. You will pay taxes, Ian. I will pay taxes. Everyone listening will pay taxes unless they are desperately poor. But guys like Donald Trump, they will lie, cheat, steal, and their tax rates will turn out to be bupkis.
And presumably you got that one tax return because it was the most favorable amongst the others that apparently Richie Neal has, the chair of the House, well, is going to get, or we don't know.
I believe I've covered Donald longer than anybody else, more than 30 years, and I believe Donald had that return sent to me. It says client copy on it. And I think he did so because he expected I would write a story that says, look at all the money he made and look at the high tax rate he paid. What Donald forgot, because he doesn't pay any attention to details, is that while he claims to be the greatest tax expert in the history of the world, the quote on that is in the making of Donald Trump, I'm a bona fide tax expert, and I read the tax return and immediately figured out what it really meant. And, you know, let me tell you how much Donald Trump lies. The White House confirmed the accuracy of the document and then claimed Trump paid more income taxes than he did, which almost every major news organization didn't look at the document and didn't say, wait a minute, the White House said this number, that's wrong. The tax return shows a different number. The very next day, we first reported this at DC Report, and then I went on Rachel Maddow. The next day, Trump went on Tucker Carlson's show on CNN, and he said his income was $100 million higher than it was. He inflated it by 67%.
Well, that's one of many lies, a blizzard of lies. David, we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us here today.
Anytime, Ian.
Thanks a lot. And again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump, a 13-year veteran of The New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, and he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States, and he recently co-founded DCReport.org, and his latest book is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the Democrats are forming a circular firing squad ahead of the 2020 elections.
Outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Frances Kissling, the president of the Center for Health, Ethics, and Social Policy. She teaches reproductive health and ethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the board of the Journal of Feminist Ethics. She also teaches art at UNAM, the Autonomous National University in Mexico, and was the president of Catholics for Choice for 25 years, stepping down in 2007 when she became a Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Kissling.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Frances. And what do you make of what's happening with Joe Biden? The impression I get is that President Obama, obviously, who he served as Obama's vice president, and in many ways the impression I get is that Biden might well be doing himself a favor if he does step down to sort of maintain the legacy of the Obama-Biden years, which most people look upon fondly, particularly now with the wrecking crew in the White House. But at a town hall meeting in Berlin on Saturday, President Obama said, "One of the things I do worry about sometimes among progressives in the United States is a certain kind of rigidity where they say, I'm sorry, this is how it's going to be. And then we start sometimes creating what's called a circular firing squad, where you start shooting at your allies because one of them is straying from purity on the issues. And when that happens, typically the overall effort weakens the movement." It's pretty hard for me to get my head around the woman that said that he touched her and kissed her, which I'm sure she's absolutely telling the truth, but she also went on to say that it wasn't sexual and it wasn't a big deal. So the question one asks is then, why go public? So what's your sense of how this is manifesting itself, both as a social issue and a legal issue? Because the man in the White House is a sexual harasser and a sexual assaulter. And I think by comparison, I think Biden is kind of a goofy, inappropriate, somewhat out of touch guy.
Right. I think I agree with you in essence. I mean, I think that, first of all, given the nature of Trump's transgressions against women, everything from I could grab their pussy and they'd let me do it kind of thing, along with the many women who have accused him of much more than being cozy. And, you know, Trump is not a comforting uncle. He never thought of himself as a comforting uncle. And we're paying so much attention to Biden and so little attention to continuing to deal with Trump's violations. And so, you know, I think there is a grave injustice, and I do think it's true. I mean, first of all, I think, you know, Biden's awkwardness, shall we say, in terms of too much touching, is new. This is new, and we like what's new and shiny. And we forget the pervasive misconduct, sexual misconduct of Trump. So I think there is some danger to that in the political, certainly in the political context. I think we have to look at the cultural context and the political context. Politically, Biden has done nothing to disqualify him from running for office. He should be judged on his record. We also have a very strong bench of Democrats. So it's not as if Biden decided to step aside or if the heat got too much and it made sense for him to step aside, that the Democrats have absolutely nobody else who could win the presidency. So I think we have to keep that in mind as well. Culturally, Biden is substantially out of touch with not just changing mores, but long time mores. I mean, it's much worse now because we have the sexual abuse crisis. So we are always very, in the Catholic Church, so we're always very worried about any touch of children. We'll deal with that. And in general, from the feminist side of things, the idea of permission has, you know, has gotten to be very, very dominant. So it's complicated.
Well, it's clearly complicated, but there's no question that Trump is capitalizing on attacking Biden. He's made
yes.
tweeted a video that's a kind of cartoon spoof of Biden touching.
Yeah.
And you recall, of course, that Trump, he was attacking Elizabeth Warren for the longest time, and he stopped doing that because I think she's sort of fading in the polls, even though she's the one candidate who seems to come up with concrete platforms and proposals. So my sense is that Trump, if you look at who he's attacking, it's always somebody that he's afraid of or that could do him some harm. And now he's attacking
right.
Biden. So to my mind, that means that Biden's a viable candidate in Trump's mind, which is worth noting, I think.
I think so, too. Although I don't think that Biden has I think Biden is a very, very good candidate for president. You know, probably among the best, if not the best that we have. At the same time, we do need someone who can punch back on Trump. And I would say so far, Biden has not done a very good job of responding to what Trump has had to say. He has not taken Trump on. And like with Warren, didn't take Trump on either. And I think the longer you wait to take Trump on face front, the more likely your star is going to fade.
Well, the one person who...
Biden has to get up his gumption, you know?
But, Francis, the one person who's taking on Trump is Bernie Sanders. And I think by all measures, he's the leading candidate of the Democrats.
Exactly.
And he makes no bones about it. He says this man is a racist and a misogynist, etc. And I think he would really give Trump a run for his money.
I think you're right. That's exactly. I mean, I think you're you know, saying what I'm saying, that Sanders takes Trump on, and he gets away with it. He does it, and the bully backs off Trump. Biden doesn't take Trump on, and so the way in which Trump presents him presents Biden, combined with the way you know the Me Too movement takes Biden on makes his run more difficult.
And again, I'm speaking with Frances Kissling, who's the president of the Center for Health, Ethics and Social Policy. She teaches reproductive health and ethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the board of the Journal of Feminist Ethics. And she teaches art at UNAM, the Autonomous National University in Mexico, and was the president of Catholics for Choice for 25 years, stepping down in 2007 when she became a Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard. So let's talk a little bit about, the kind of disparity between the sins of the Republicans, in particular Trump. What is more graphic than having the Secretary of Labor, this sleazy guy who led off the most despicable, sleazy child trafficker and sexual assaulter of young girls? He trolled the malls for them and sent them to his island, and a bunch of rich buddies of his had their way with these young girls and ruined their lives. And this guy gets off, and he's a friend of Trump's. He's also apparently some of the Clinton nodes as well. So it's not entirely a Republican disgrace. But the whole litany on Trump's side, we don't have to repeat it. But then if you think about the casualties on the Democratic side who are falling foul while Trump is essentially skated and pretty much unscathed, you know, Franken was a very effective senator. He was a guy mm-hmm. that caught Sessions in a lie and undermined him and caused him to have to recuse himself, which drove Trump crazy. He also did a very good job questioning that ridiculous Secretary of Education that we have, Betsy DeVos. The Prairie Home Companion guy, Garrison Keillor, was very effective, speaking to the heartland, always making fun of Republicans, and he's gone. So I'm just wondering why it is that there's this double standard, that I'm not making excuses for these guys on the Democratic side, but they do seem to get nailed for much less egregious behavior than Trump is guilty of.
They get nailed, but they fold. They fold. Franken folded. He resigned. In my opinion, he should have stayed in the game. He should have allowed the ethics process to go through, and he should not have allowed the women members of Congress and everybody else to cause him to leave. There is a certain there's such a character difference in Democrats and Republicans. I mean, it's not just true of Trump. There are other Republican senators and Congress people who have gotten in trouble and who have just stood it out and not ended up resigning. And that's what Trump does. Garrison Keillor, well, he also, you know, his station wouldn't continue, but he also didn't make what you would call as a vigorous defense of himself. And so I think we do deal with the fact that the members themselves, the politicians themselves on the Democratic side who get in trouble, throw in the towel, and they are attacked by their own. And we see that on the Republican side, the Republican office holders do not throw in the towel. They're very aggressive about we didn't do it or whatever, or it wasn't a big deal, leave me alone. And the other Republicans don't go after him. I mean, we look at the way the Republican Congress is totally silent as Trump, aside from his sexual abuse of women, is you know, destroying the democracy in every way, and they're just absolutely fine with it.
Well, do you think it's going to be revived, Trump's sexual predatory, with this Herman Cain, a total insult to everybody? He's putting him on the Fed board. But this guy, Cain, had to step down from the presidential race because of charges of sexual harassment and sexual impropriety with a number of women, I believe. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's going to come back? Obviously, there's many other reasons to criticize Herman Cain for being just an embarrassing and ridiculous choice. But apparently...
Unqualified.
Yeah. But do you think that'll come... In the hearings that...
No.
You don't?
No. No. First of all, we've seen this. The Trump base does not care about anything that Trump does of that sort. Any characterological failures, whether it's sexual, constitutional, financial, etc., they don't care. And as long as they don't care, and as long as Republican members of Congress still believe, are fearful that if Trump goes against them when they go up for election, they will be defeated, we will not see this stuff reemerge.
Well, it is obviously an extraordinary double standard, and I don't understand why it is that his supporters, I understand they're in the Fox bubble, and to that extent you can blame Rupert Murdoch more than Trump, but the idea that they're immune to evidence and facts seems to persist. So what would your recommendation be from the feminist perspective, Frances, of how the Democrats can handle this going forward, particularly keeping in mind President Obama's warning, you know, essentially to encapsulate what he's saying, that the perfect is the enemy of the good, and that too much purity and not enough pragmatism is a recipe for disaster.
Right. Well, I think that those of us in the feminist movement and those in the Me Too movement, which are not precisely overlapping, but they're very much overlapping, we have to continue to pay attention to Trump. I mean, we cannot let the Trump thing go. And you don't hear us writing or talking so much about Trump. And so that definitely has to pick up, and it has to pick up strongly. And it means some more radical action, really, in terms of as difficult it is being present at his rallies you know, giving him a hard time as he's getting on his plane, you know, picketing at Mar-a-Lago, making him totally and completely uncomfortable everywhere he goes. Because if you make him uncomfortable, he will make a lot of mistakes.
Well,
and we're not doing that. We have to. We have to go. We, you know. Again, you said it at the very beginning. The reaction from the Democratic women's side, the feminist side, etc., is disproportionate in going after people like Biden or Franken or whoever else at any given moment, and ignoring at the present moment Trump's violations. We have to bring back the women who were charging Trump during the campaign with violations. I think that's the best thing, is to be laser focused on Trump. And I think I think there is this fear among those of us who are strong believers in feminism, strongly against violence against women, strongly concerned about sexual abuse. There is this fear that if we don't take on our own, we will look complicit. We will look like we don't care about these things. And I do think that can get to be an overkill. I think right now we're in an overkill period in terms of, oh, my God, we have to show our purity by going after our people. And, of course, we have to make statements, and we have to, you know, We don't ignore it, but we must have a much stronger message and a much stronger attempt to defeat Trump and his cronies.
Well,
we don't have that right now.
I like your advice, and of course Trump has been making some unforced errors recently.
Yeah.
So if you pile on a little bit, maybe all of the women that, I think there's 16 of them altogether, maybe they should be picketing the White House in Lafayette Square, you know. I was harassed by...
Right, where are they? Where are those 19 women today?
Right,
How is the women's movement making common cause with those 19 women and using our money and our voice to promote them?
Well, Frances, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate the conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Frances Kissling, who's the president of the Center for Health, Ethics, and Social Policy. She teaches reproductive health and ethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the board of the Journal of Feminist Ethics. And she teaches art at UNAM, the Autonomous National University in Mexico, and was the president of Catholics for Choice for 25 years, stepping down in 2007 when she became a Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Fire.